This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. There's a big issue, you know it's important, you want to get a handle on it. Me too. That's why I hang around the briefing room waiting to get the best information from people who know what they're talking about. Now, whether light or rather darkness visible, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. Recent reviewers include Plymouth's Finest, Rib Carter and Bright Green Bear. Join them and I'll read out your handle too. This week we're asking, after the right-wing candidate Jair Bolsonaro won 46% in the first round of the presidential election in Brazil, could this huge country be on the brink of taking a radical new political direction? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to download other editions of The Briefing Room. This is the man who seems set to be Brazil's next president.
Vamos fuzilar a petralhada aqui do Acre!
Let's shoot the PT cronies here. If they like Venezuela so much, then they must go there. Please record this. Record this. She's saying I'm a rapist. I'll never rape you because you're not worth it. If the child starts acting a bit gay, if he gets a good beating, he would change his behavior. I've heard some people telling me, I'm glad my dad spanked me, for he taught me to be a man.
Last week, Jair Bolsonaro won 46% of the vote in the first round of presidential elections in Latin America's largest country. The runoff election is in just over a fortnight. So who is Jair Bolsonaro? How has he come to be odds-on favourite for president? And what happens if he wins? Step inside the briefing room to find out. First, let's get briefed on the background. Dr. Mahrukh Doctor, senior lecturer at the School of Politics, Philosophy and International Studies at the University of Hull, takes us through the recent political history of South America's most populous country.
In 2002, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, normally known as Lula, won the election on his fourth attempt at becoming president of Brazil.
Vamos acabar com a fome em nosso país. Transformemos.
Let us rid our country of hunger. Let us make the end of hunger our national goal. If, at the end of my term, all Brazilians are able to eat breakfast, lunch and supper, I will have succeeded in my life's mission.
A missão da minha vida.
He serves two terms, the constitutional limit, and was extremely popular. In fact, not just with ordinary people, but also with the business community. This is because he had very sensible macroeconomic policies. He was lucky in that he presided over Brazil at the height of the commodity boom. And this allowed Lula great fiscal space to implement social policies, which is, of course, at the heart of what the PT had always been about.
I will govern this country for all Brazilians, but in my thinking and in my actions, the poorest will have priority.
However, when he starts wanting to implement policy changes on certain things, he has to deal with Congress. Many of these parties have no programmatic allegiance to what the PT is trying to do. And soon it is found out in around 2005 that there's this massive payments, the so-called mensalão or big payment, monthly payment scandal, which implicates many members of Congress. At the time, it is quickly sort of brushed aside almost. The scandal settles down. He, in fact, wins re-election in 2006. But this time, not because of support from the, the public servants and their unions or even the business community and the middle class, but rather from the poor in the Northeast who have now, of course, been benefiting from the social policy side of things. Of course, in 2008, the global financial crisis, Brazil weathers it very well. And in fact, it starts growing very rapidly after 2009. So when the elections come around in 2010, Lula was pretty much free to choose who his successor would be. And sure enough, although the opposition gives a tough fight, Dilma Rousseff is sworn in as president on 1st January 2011.
I believe and will work for us all to be united to make the necessary changes in education, in health and security, and above all, in the fight to end poverty and misery.
But growth is slowing around the world. The external context is changing slightly. A recession sets in late 2014, and then when the corruption scandals hit, implicating all the political party, what you see is greater disillusionment with the political class. So in March 2014 is the first time the public heard about Operation Car Wash, Lava Jato in Portuguese. It referred to the place where bribed money would be exchanged hands at one of the petrol pumps in Brasilia. The scandal involved primarily the state-owned oil company Petrobras, at the time the largest company in Latin America, seen as one of the most successful companies during the Lula years. And here this company, it is exposed, is really being used to milk the system for corrupt politicians, corrupt campaign funds, and so on. Dilma Rousseff herself, although she had been a chair of the board of Petrobras in much of those crucial years, as the Minister of Mines and Energy under President Lula, somehow manages to distance herself from direct involvement. However, the growing disenchantment with the PT in general, whether President Dilma directly or not was involved in it, means that the population starts, let's say, coming out on the streets, protesting the government. The economy, meanwhile, is turning into a bad situation. Growth is literally stopped. Unemployment increases. And the sense in Congress is, given the slow growth and the people's disgust with the government, it would be a good time to move against her.
The Constitution is clear. It says for an impeachment, there needs to be a crime. If there is no crime, this impeachment process takes an innocent person from the government. And that is a coup, a parliamentary coup.
The final vote at the end of August in 2016 sees 61 of the 81 senators voting to impeach her. Once she's impeached, President Temer takes office. He immediately appeals to a wide coalition of parties to support him in government, and many do. But while things seem to start on a very promising note from his point of view initially, there is always in the background the fact of how he is implicated in various corruption scandals. So he becomes utterly discredited. However, people were tired of going through another impeachment process, even more economic and political instability. And everyone said, well, by the time the whole system moves forward, we'll anyway be having elections the following year. So the story of the last 15, 18 years in Brazil has been one going from an extremely popular president, President Lula, to a successor chosen by him, but very soon absolutely rejected by the population as well as the political class itself, replaced by someone, President Temer, who has very little credibility, and then the elections now in 2018 allowing an anti-establishment candidate to come to the fore and actually having some people really alarmed about the prospects for the survival of democracy in Brazil.
Maruk Doctor, out of that disillusion has risen Jair Bolsonaro. So who is he? With me now on the line from Sao Paulo is Katie Watson, the BBC South America correspondent. Katie Watson, who is Jair Bolsonaro? Where does he come from?
So Jair Bolsonaro has been a congressman for nearly 30 years. Before that, he was in the army. So he has had a long political career, although he does paint himself as a kind of fresh outsider. But in those nearly 30 years, he's managed to pass just two bills he's proposed. So he's been in Brasilia, in the capital, for a long time. But in terms of having a powerful platform, up until recently, that's not been the case. But just in the past few years, the past year, really, it's been an absolute turnaround. So now his party, the Social Liberal Party, does hold the second most number of seats in Congress after the Workers' Party. So he's really shot up just in the last year or so.
So you're saying that Bolsonaro has never really been that significant a person up until very recently?
No, and that's what's so interesting, is that he's not been affiliated to any large parties. His Social Liberal Party has really taken off. In fact, in the first round, when we saw legislative elections as well, there was a lot of talk of, Jair Bolsonaro is this interesting character, but even if he was put into power, then he wouldn't necessarily be very strong in Congress, because Brazilian Congress is so fragmented, and so getting any extreme laws that he's proposed probably wouldn't happen. But what we've seen is that anybody allied to his party seems to have done very well. And actually, within just overnight, his party did manage to gain a lot of seats. And that does mean that if he was to become president, then he would have much more power than perhaps people had originally thought.
We'll go on to a moment to talk about his political appeal to voters. But is he at all a charismatic figure?
It's a tricky one. No, I mean, he's no Lula, the former president and the leader of the Workers' Party, who is now locked up in jail on corruption charges. And he was the front runner in these elections before he was told he couldn't run, and he was replaced by Fernando Haddad, who is now opposing Jair Bolsonaro. So he's not charismatic in that sense, but he's a straight talker. He sells himself as a no-nonsense politician. He's on message for so many people in Brazil.
In a country where there's an awful lot of talk about corruption, there's an awful lot of corruption, apparently. Is he squeaky clean? Is he somehow managed to come out of this smelling of roses?
Well, that's probably his biggest selling point, is that it doesn't have any corruption probes against him. That said, this week was traumatic for his team, because his economic advisor, Paulo Guedes, there was news that the public prosecutor's office was investigating him over alleged links to pension fund fraud. And he's the economic guru, because Bolsonaro himself has said that he doesn't really know much about economics. So that wobbled the markets. But since then, there's been polls showing that Jair Bolsonaro is doing very well. So, I just don't think these things matter. I think that's what's so interesting about this campaign.
Okay, so the first time I ever heard of him was when he got stabbed. What happened there? Is he okay?
So he was stabbed at a campaign rally, probably about a month ago now. And initially it seemed superficial, but it was quite serious. It stopped him going out on campaigns. He was in hospital until just a week ago or so. But it hasn't stopped his rise. His sons, who are also politicians, took on the campaigning. He's sold it well as the issue with Brazil and the issue that he talks about is that violence is on the up and he's one of the candidates to solve it. And he himself was a victim of the violence. So it certainly helped his campaign.
Now, trying to distinguish between what's support for him and what's support for his position, if Lula had not been in prison and had been able to run, do you think we would be looking at the same statistics? Or are there people actually who will be voting for Bolsonaro who would actually have voted for Lula?
Yes. What's really interesting about this, I mean, I think it's a question of who is hated more as opposed to who is liked more in this race. I mean, there's so much anger towards the Workers' Party, so that's Lula. People see the Workers' Party as this symbol of everything that's gone wrong. They were meant to be better and they ended up being as bad, if not worse. So that said, because he lifted so many millions out of poverty and he was this different, very charismatic politician, there are millions of people who still support him, feel that he's been put into prison under politically motivated charges, and that's not fair. So Fernando Haddad has worked very hard to try and gain those votes from Lula, transfer those votes from Lula. He hasn't succeeded totally. He's a Sao Paulo mayor who, if you go up to the northeast, they don't know who he is. I mean, I was talking to somebody in Rio and I said to him, in a favela, a poor area of Rio, and I said, who are you voting for? And he said, I'm going to vote for Lula. I mean, Andrade, and just said this random name because he didn't even know who he was. And I think that's the problem, is that he hasn't got the support that Lula has, which is why he's perhaps in second place. If it had been a Lula-Bolsonaro scenario, that would have just been bonkers and fascinating. But as it is, you know, people are voting for Bolsonaro a lot because they hate the Workers' Party so much, not just because Bolsonaro is going to change Brazil.
Katie Watson. Now, that's the man. If it seems most likely he wins, what would Jair Bolsonaro do? And what might it mean for Brazil? To help me with these questions, I've welcomed into the briefing room Marika Riethoff, lecturer in Latin American politics at the University of Liverpool, and Richard Lapper, an associate fellow at Chatham House, who was for many years Latin American editor at the Financial Times. Richard Lapper, what are the key factors that have led to this shift to the right in Brazil?
David, I think we're talking about three or four factors that have come together. First, the economic crisis that began really in 2013-14, Brazil slipped into recession, partially as a result of international factors, the falling commodity prices, the slowdown in China, to which Brazil's very, very connected. And those problems were aggravated by, I think, what I would describe as a mismanagement of the economy, a failure to really engender business confidence, and a gradual slowdown that led Brazil into quite a deep recession in 2015-16, a contraction in the order of 3.5% per year. Now, during that period, this was the period of the second term of Dilma Rousseff, unemployment rose very sharply. We saw an increase in unemployment from around about 6% to 12%. That's 6 million people more out of work. That was against a background of very steady progress over the previous 15 years, where Brazilians had got used to getting better off. The good times had led to high expectations, and the bad times were really felt very hard indeed. I think what happened was part of that, you know, we saw a big increase in criminality. So really, from around 2014-15, a large increase in homicide rates, which had been falling, actually, in the early 2000s. But they began to rise. Crime began to spread. We began to see endemic crime in previously quite peaceful states in the northeast of Brazil. And, you know, in some of those states, we saw crime levels rising to really very, very high levels. You know, internationally, some of the highest levels in the world. As a result of that, Brazilians began to get slightly paranoid about crime. You don't have to be in Brazil for longer than 5-10 minutes to see or watch TV, Brazilian TV. There's always violent crime on TV. And then layered on top of that was the disaster, really, of the Lava Jato investigations. It began as an investigation into money laundering and essentially stumbled across, by accident at first, various padded contracts that had been paid by a cartel of privately held construction companies to the state-owned, state-directed oil company Petrobras, and money had gone to politicians in backhanders. And that sort of cocktail of problems, corruption, crime, economic slowdown, I think is gets us to this election campaign.
Thank you, Richard. Marika Riethoff, is this vote that's coming up, is it more of a protest against the Workers' Party, or is it a vote in favour of what they think Bolsonaro could achieve?
It's a mix, the support for Bolsonaro. I think his core vote is not around 50% or 58%, as the current polls suggest. So his core vote is around probably 20-25% of people who share his values and also feel attracted to his agenda because they are worried about violence, which is quite understandable in a Brazilian context. There's a very large level of dissatisfaction of the way democracy works in Brazil. Polls indicate that in Brazil since the late 1980s, the transition to democracy, that Brazilians believe in the principle of democracy. So they're not necessarily supporting a move towards a military regime or a non-democratic solution, but they're very dissatisfied of how their democracy works, and that is associated with corruption and also the sense, a very, very strong sense that people feel that politicians govern only for a minority of rich people and not for the general masses of Brazilians.
Is there any significant chance, Richard Lapper, of a Haddad victory, of a surprise Workers' Party victory?
I don't think there is. I mean, it's a very, very tall order for Haddad to win this. He's shifting the turn of his campaign, trying to appeal to centre votes. But he's got to win an enormous number of people who either didn't vote in the first round or voted for parties that were not with Bolsonaro. Can I just add, in terms of the factors leading to this, there's been a silent move rightwards in terms of conservative social values in Brazil, very much associated with the rise of the evangelical Protestant church. 33% of Brazilians, according to the most recent polls, are evangelical Christians. And they really are adhered to very conservative values, anti-gay marriage, anti-homosexuality. They're against equal opportunities in terms of race, etc. There is a very, despite its image of being quite a libertarian, a liberal place in terms of sexuality, I think Brazil's quite conservative. And this movement of the evangelical church has really pitched Brazil much more to the right. And it shifted the PT's rule was associated
That's
with
the Workers' Party.
Liberal social measures.
Let's try and shift this forward now to what will happen after a Bolsonaro victory, if that's what happens. Richard, what immediate problems does the new President Bolsonaro face?
As Marika said, you know, the big demand, in a way, that Bolsonaro has to answer is how does he start to solve criminality? His answer to that is frankly more violence, right? He is prepared to liberalise Brazilian gun laws and allow the army and police to go into favelas without the normal constraints.
These are the slums.
Basically, they see a criminal, shoot to kill, essentially. Now, the problem with that is it doesn't really work. We've seen, going back to 2006 in Mexico, when Felipe Calderón, a conservative president in Mexico, led a war on drugs. It didn't work. He sent the army and it didn't work. It led actually to more violence. The problem is that when you do that, you get a lot of people who are in the middle, are quite innocent, get killed.
Marika Riethoff, what about dealing with corruption? If we identify corruption as being one of the major reasons that got Bolsonaro into the presidency, what does he have to do in order to root out what seems to be pretty endemic corruption?
Interestingly, his prospective economics minister, Paulo Guedes, is under investigation at the moment for corruption. So he doesn't seem to be immune to the allegations and the investigations himself. So one of the debates at the moment is that the fear that if Haddad and the Workers' Party come to power, that they would end the corruption investigations. And it seems there is a lot of support among Brazilians to continue rooting out corruption. But that is obviously very complicated. And one of the sources of the complications I foresee is that Bolsonaro will have to form a majority coalition in his government and in Congress. And Congress at the moment in the current vote has a conservative majority. So the Workers' Party is the largest party, but he would in theory be able to form a majority in Congress. And Congress is very fragmented, so there are 30 parties of different political ideas and sometimes very unclear identities. And in the Brazilian case, forming a coalition means negotiating, horse trading, making compromises. And that doesn't just involve politicians and political parties, but also businesses associated with the state, the public sector. And that has been in Brazil a source of corruption. And I think Bolsonaro will really struggle to build a stable majority without this kind of compromise strategy.
Richard Lapper, do you think he will be able to carry out the kind of economic reforms and create the climate whereby the Brazilian economy is put back on track?
Again, it's a tall order. Another feature of the Bolsonaro campaign is his very strong pro-US stance. This, to some extent, the Trump administration, in all its aspects, is the North Star of this government. Now, the problem with that is that Brazil is becoming more and more dependent on its trade relations with China. China's the biggest trading partner. It's been a huge source of investment capital. If Bolsonaro were to, as he's promised to do at certain points in the past, to take a belligerent attitude towards Chinese involvement, that could be very damaging for the economy. I think the other risk is, as Marika's indicated, there is a governability problem. I mean, this is a very his party has got about 10% of legislatures. He's got to build a broad alliance to be able to govern. He's not got a great deal of experience in doing that. Paulo Guedes is under fire. I think probably will survive that. But there is a big challenge out there in terms of a very large fiscal deficit. Brazil's spending far more than it is bringing in taxes and can borrow. This is not necessarily an easy one.
Marika Ritoff, do you think that there's any significant danger, given that Bolsonaro has spoken in glowing terms in the past about Brazil's past military dictatorships, do you think that there's any significant danger that he would, in a sense, contemplate authoritarian rule?
One of the problematic issues that he's proposed is that if he struggles to govern in a democratic way, that he would be prepared to circumvent a constitutional framework in Brazil. That is a very worrying situation. He's also criticized the democratic constitution of 1988, the first post-dictatorship constitution. So there is a worry that he would turn towards authoritarianism. And one element of that will be repression, police and military repression of violence, of demonstrations. And the other aspect would be a rejection of democratic institutions, which is very worrying in a young democracy like Brazil.
Richard Lapper, for a while, Brazil was held up as a kind of poster boy for what could be achieved in Latin America, both democratically and for ordinary people and economically. Now, what would it mean for Latin America more broadly if Bolsonaro were to win and then go ahead with the sort of agenda we've been hearing about?
You know, I think we are seeing a right-wing populist phenomenon emerging in Latin America, of which this is the strongest expression to date. Hitherto, I mean, populism in Latin America has been of a left-wing variety. You think of Hugo Chavez or the Kirchners in Argentina or the Ecuadorians or whatever. This is something new on this scale. In fact, we're seeing slightly similar phenomenon in Central America, some of the smaller republics in Central America, where there are similar kinds of authoritarian populism, very much triggered by fear and insecurity in those contexts too. I think we've got a very strong populist right-wing movement in Peru that's currently on the defensive, but potentially could become an important political force. So I think we're seeing a shift rightwards more generally to more traditional conservatives, liberal conservatives like Mauricio Macri in Argentina. In Europe, right-wing populism, the target is immigration, and it's especially Islamic immigration. The target for right-wing populism in Latin America, I think, would be criminality and organized crime and insecurity. This is worth looking at. It could be potentially very, very significant. Can I just add, in terms of authoritarianism, I think there's no question Bolsonaro has authoritarian instincts. He's let everyone know that. I think with the scale of the congressional shift to the right and the way that particularly the centre parties actually have been reduced in number really means that Bolsonaro can form an alliance on the right, and it makes him actually less likely to resort to authoritarian measures.
Richard Lapper there and Marika Riethoff. And my thanks to Maruk Doctor and Katie Watson. We'll be back in a few weeks. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. The producers were Neil Koenig, Serena Tarling and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And we really would like to hear from you.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.